Of all the wonders that I yet have heard, it seems to me most strange that men should fear seeing that death.
This week on The Historics is the second part series of the Julius Caesar saga, his early years, his gradual rise to power, and everything in between. Welcome back to The Historics with Cece. I am Chioma Okorafor. This is a historical podcast where we bring you true, factual, interesting, and historical stories that happened way, way back in the past. Some of these stories you may know, as in they're very popular and are well known, while some might be totally new to you. That means you don't know them, and you really should get to know them. Our history lesson today continues with the life of Julius Caesar. Imagine being born in the Roman ancient civilization, the era of the Caesars, of the Emperors, of the Augustuses, in the times when warriors and gladiators fought in the Colosseum, wielding their swords and engaging in bloody fights. The fight to the death kind of fight, not the normal WWE fight we have now, no. The kind of fight that ended up with one or both of the gladiators dead. The days of one ancient civilization overthrowing another. The era of the nuns and the ides of the Calends. The era of conspiracies and betrayals. Basically, the era of Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar was a Roman general who was a key figure in the formation of the Roman Empire at about 2,000 years ago. He was not just a general, he was also, in these days, you can call him an influencer. He was an orator, he was a statesman, he was a consul, he was a lawyer, among a ton of other positions he held in his time. Words cut short, he was a force to reckon with. Julius Caesar was born into a patrician family known as the Gens Julia family. This family claimed to be descendants of the goddess Venus. His first name was Gaius, and his family names were Julius or Gens Julia, and then Caesar. Now, when I say families, there were actually two families. Julius was the name of the big clan which his family belonged to, while Caesar was the name of the branch of the clan that was his family. That we have a big clan called the Gens Julia clan, and then we have the Caesar family. Julius Caesar's clan, the patrician clan of Gens Julia, was one of the oldest and earliest families in Rome. What does the word itself, patrician, mean? Now, it comes from Latin origins. It comes from a Latin word, patris, which means fathers. So I think we could basically say the patrician families are like the founding fathers of Rome. And that means they control the political, religious, and military leadership of Rome. Basically, these families ruled Rome. Yeah, as at the time of Julius Caesar's birth, the patrician families ruled Rome. So Julius Caesar was born in 100 BC around the 12th or 13th of July. We do not exactly know the date of his birth, but we know it was in the year 100 BC on either the 12th day or 13th day of July. And we do know his parents were Julius Gaius Caesar Senior and Aurelia Cotta. Of course, in those days, it wasn't senior or junior. It was just Julius Caesar, the father, and Julius Caesar, the son. But of course, in these days, we'll have something like Julius Caesar Senior and Julius Caesar Junior. Although Julius Caesar was born into a noble family, his family was not exactly influential when it came to Roman politics. You see, the Romans practiced a clear-cut class system, where they had the high class, or we could call it the upper class, who were mostly the patricians and the aristocrats. Then we had the middle class, who were a little above average and lived a comfortable life, per se. Then we had the lower class, which was like the poor people, the commoners, and some immigrants. Now, they didn't go all out and call them poor. They just called them lower class. But of course, we know this referred to this set of people I mentioned, the commoners in Rome, the foreigners in Rome, and immigrants that came from other countries and settled in Rome. At the time of Julius Caesar's birth, his family belonged to the highest class, but at that time they had fallen on really rough times. They didn't even have a great political or military record. They were more or less what you call now the cash poor. What does cash poor mean? The family still had some properties to their name, like they still had some farmlands and a decent amount of property. And that was probably their only bargaining chip for still retaining their place in the upper class. But they didn't really have money to spend, as in the way the aristocrats and the patricians would be expected to spend money. They weren't like that. They were basically cash poor, but a bit rich in farmlands and a few properties. Due to the situation of Julius Caesar's family, where he was born and at the time he was born, Caesar grew up in a lower to middle class neighborhood. This neighborhood was known as Subera. And he grew up among these foreigners and immigrants that we talked about in the lower class of the society. So basically, Julius Caesar had a normal childhood as a normal kid. He didn't have the kind of childhood you would expect the aristocrats and the children of the patrician family to have. He just had a normal childhood, grew up in a normal way, not much spending of money on his tutelage. There were two factors that helped him politically. One, his mother Aurelia was from a very powerful family in Rome, so he got some political connections through her. Secondly, his aunt, that is his father's sister, Julia, got married to a very powerful and famous Roman general called Marius Gaius. And through this relationship, Julius Caesar became even more exposed to a stronger political connection. As a matter of fact, it was his relationship with Marius that helped to set the tone of young Julius Caesar venturing into politics quite early in life. Now, who exactly was Marius Gaius, aside from being Julius Caesar's uncle-in-law? He was a man who was born into an aristocratic family, and he became a war hero with time. He was especially liked by the Roman citizens because he fought on their behalf. He wasn't the type of person who would agitate for wealth to be distributed just among the Senate or the upper class. He was for the people, basically a man of the people. He was actually a populist. Now, as at that time in Rome, there are two opposing factions, made up of the Senate. We had the populists on one hand, and we had the optimates on the other hand. The populists, gotten from the Latin word popularis, which means supporters of the people. We are people who fought for the good of the people, who fought for the needs of the people, who fought for the wishes of the people. While the optimates, on the other hand, fought for their own political gains and fought for their own selfish interests. So during the time of Julius Caesar's early age, we have the optimates on one hand and we have the popularis on the other hand. An important point to note here, Julius Caesar's uncle, at a point in Rome, even there was a civil war after which Marius got exiled, but he later returned and ruled Rome alongside his friend and co-dictator Cinna. We are going to talk about Cinna later on in this story, but just know that at this point, these two had become really authoritarian figures in Rome, and they would actually play a very important part in Julius Caesar's life much later. Now, there is not a lot of information about Julius Caesar's early years, but we do know that around age six, his parents hired a private tutor called Marcus Antonius. to tutor him at home. This was basically the practice then, as at this point in ancient Rome. Instead of the children going to public schools, the parents that could afford it hired tutors to come teach their children at home. So that was the same case with Julius Caesar. And that was where he started imbibing the qualities that would make him a great leader much later in the future. As for the physical appearance of, how Julius Caesar actually looked like, he was described as very tall, handsome, with a full face, rather fair skin, dark, bright, and piercing eyes, with a high, straight nose, and quite skinny. This does paint a picture of a very handsome man. And he was also described as a very good athlete that participated in athletics like horseback riding, javelin throwing, mostly physical activities. In 86 and 85 BC respectively, Julius Caesar experienced two major losses in his life. One, his uncle Marius Gaius died. Two, he lost his father in 85 BC. Julius Caesar was just 16 years old, very young actually. Well, he was that age when his father died, and so the death of his father automatically set him up to become the head of his household. And this household included his mother, his sister, the servants of the house, and everything they owned. So the way I see it, he became exposed to leadership quite early in life. And this really helped him as he would occupy a lot of leadership positions in his life. In 87 BC, Caesar was appointed Flamen Daelis. The position of Flamen Daelis is one of the oldest priesthood positions in Rome, and it's a priesthood office that is meant to be occupied for life. It's not like a one-year tenure like we had the Roman governors. No, it's one-off deal. Like, it's a position that you go for life. The Flamen Daelis is a high priest of Jupiter, exclusively devoted to the worship of Jupiter. You don't worship Venus, you don't worship Mars, you must worship the god Jupiter. Now, this was not a bad position for somebody like Caesar. After all, he didn't really have a very proud military or political background to speak of. He was only from a patrician family. They didn't even have much money. So for him to occupy that position of Flamen Daelis, it was like a big deal as at that point in time for Caesar. He must have been satisfied. It's okay. I can deal with this while just living my life in a very respectable position. And I can go with this flow. I'm sure that was what young Caesar must have been thinking by then. However, there is a downside of this position. And here it is. Caesar was never ever going to be in the military or politically advance any career he had regarding politics, because according to the rules governing this position, a priest should never get involved in civic or civilian affairs. See, the Romans believed that a priest was higher than mere civilians. Hence, he should not get involved in the mundane affairs of civilians. The Romans were actually a highly, highly religious people. Some of the other ancient traditions that were associated with this position was that Caesar was not allowed to sleep outside of Rome for more than 2 to 3 nights. He couldn't see a dead body, even if it happened to be his relative. He had to sleep with mud around his bed. He couldn't go horseback riding, and all sorts of binding rules that accompany this position. Now, this means that Caesar was going to be respected all his life and was going to be in a quote-unquote prestigious position, but he was going to be bound to the same traditions all his life. And if he had any plans of going outside of Rome, walking outside of Rome, becoming a soldier, becoming a famous politician, that dream had died with this position. However, things were going to change for Caesar very soon, and what seemed like a disappointment would turn out to become a blessing in disguise. How did this happen? Now in 84 BC, at the age of 16, Julius Caesar got married to his very first wife. Yeah, Julius Caesar had three wives, not just one. A lot of people are acquainted with Calpurnia, who was Julius Caesar's wife as at the time of his death. But he had three wives. He had Cornelia, he had Pompeia, and finally Calpurnia. This was amongst the host of mistresses Julius Caesar had. Julius Caesar was actually a chronic womanizer. Like, he slept with married women, he dated single ladies, he even dated royalty. I'm sure a lot of us are familiar with Queen Cleopatra of Egypt, of which he actually had a son called Caesarion. But that's not our point of learning. For now, let's talk about Cornelia, the first wife of Julius Caesar. She was only 13 years old when she got married to Julius Caesar, who was just 16. Practically the same age he was when his father died. Yeah, so they got married in 84 BC. She was the daughter of Lucius Cornelius Cinna. Remember the guy we mentioned earlier? Co-dictator with Marius. Yes, the same guy. He has surfaced again. Anyway, Cornelia was his daughter. And Cinna was actually a very well-placed man in Rome. He was a councilman. Now let's talk a bit about the consulship. It's like the highest office, the highest political office in the Roman Republic. A councilman would usually serve alongside another councilman. That was a joint consulship for a period of 1 year. And Cinna had been councilman 4 years in a row. In fact, he and his friend Marius Gaius, who was Julius Caesar's uncle, were the leading figures or the leaders of the popularist faction, which we also talked about, the supporters of the people. And Julius Caesar was also a member of the popularist faction. Although the couple got married for political reasons, their union actually seemed to be a happy one. It lasted for about 15 years. In spite of the fact that Julius Caesar was a womanizer, as we've already established earlier. Well, they had a child called Julia in 74 BC. And she was most likely the only legitimate daughter of Caesar, even though we know he had two other children. There was Caesarion, who was born from his mistress Cleopatra, and then there was his grandnephew Octavius, who Julius Caesar adopted because he didn't have an heir. Around 82 BC, Julius Caesar almost lost his life and his marriage too. Now, Caesar's father-in-law, Lucius Cinna, the populist, you remember that guy? Yeah. He was a rival to Lucius Sulla. Lucius Sulla was a great Roman general who was an optimate. You remember, the populist and the optimate are on two sides of the law, like two sides of not the same coin, two sides of different coin. They had different beliefs. They had different beliefs and they had different goals. Sulla was not just Optimatus member. He was actually the leader of the Optimatus faction. Sulla was an enemy of Cinna and Marius. Why? Popularis and Optimatus. And of course, the Popularis opposed and fought against Sulla, who was the leader of the Optimatus. In 83 BC, Sulla started a civil war in Rome. By this time, Marius was already dead. So the civil war was mostly against Cinna, and it was known as the Cinna-Marius civil war. Even if Marius was dead, he had been one of the key leaders of the Popularis before he died. So it was known as the Cinna-Marius civil war. The battleground was just outside of Rome. Unfortunately, Cinna got killed in the war, and Sulla automatically won. Now, after Sulla won the civil war against the Cinna-Marius faction, he returned to Rome and started a bloody revenge mission against everyone who had been related to Cinna or Marius. How did he do this? He set this revenge of his into motion by signing into law what became known later as Sulla's proscription. The easiest way to describe what a proscription is that it's a term that is used to describe murders or banishment approved by the state. On a norm, the state does not approve of killing, except it's a capital punishment for criminals or kidnappers or people who are involved in any crime that is punishable by death. But a proscription in ancient Rome meant the state had given an order for people to be killed. Now, Sulla's proscription around 81 and 82 BC was a terrible period, really. It was a period of death in Rome. Unimaginable death rates. I mean, he used his medium to get rid of anybody who had allied themselves with Marius and Cinna. You know, their friends, their families, their supporters. Naturally, some people became collateral damage, yes. And especially the populace were worse hit. Hundreds of people lost their lives. Sulla didn't stop there. He took it a step further and started posting lists of his enemies. He described it as, quote unquote, people he didn't like. He would put their names. If you remember, the next day he would add more names to the proscription list. People were dying. There were orders. There were bounties placed on people's head. What did bounty mean? It simply meant that anybody whose name appeared on the proscribed list were marked for death, and then after they died, their properties would be confiscated. Huh. The ancient historian Plutarch puts it like this, quote, a list of persons proscribed was posted in public, and those whose names were on the list might be killed by anyone who chose to do so. Only a tiny proportion of the dead were killed because they had angered or offended someone. Far more were killed for their properties. End of quote. Now, the killers would go rewarded. Whoever killed anybody whose name appeared on the proscribed list, anybody that had a bounty on their head, the person would go rewarded. So Sulla was basically like, yeah, if you see any name on the list, go ahead and kill the person, come back to me, I'll give you a reward. He was using this medium to exterminate his enemies and any other relation that was connected to Marius or Cinna. Now imagine, this is very funny. When Sulla discovered that one of his priests, that's a priest of the Flamen Dialis, by name of Julius Caesar, was not just married to Caesar's daughter, but he was also related to Marius by marriage. I mean, Caesar was guilty by association, okay? He told Caesar to divorce his wife, Cornelia, and marry someone else. He was like, okay, fine, I won't kill you, but just divorce Cornelia. She's a daughter of Cinna, my sworn enemy, and marry someone else. That is very simple, right? I don't have to die if I just divorce my wife. I can marry someone else. There are a lot of women out there. But for reasons best known to him, either because he loved Cornelia too much or he was just wanting to be stubborn, Julius Caesar refused. He refused to divorce Cornelia. And in retaliation, Sulla stripped him of his priesthood office. He was no longer Flamen Dialis. And he also issued an order for him to be arrested. But the young Julius Caesar outsmarted him and ran away before Sulla's men could get to him. He went to southern Italy and stayed there for a while, moving from place to place, village to village, hiding out because he knew that if he was found by Sulla's soldiers or anybody who knew he was on the proscribed list, he would be killed or returned to Rome for Sulla to deal with him. At one point, he actually ran into one of Sulla's soldiers who was going to take him back to Rome for him to be killed, but he had to bribe the soldier with everything he had on him, with every penny, with everything he had, so he would not be apprehended. And afterward, he had to leave that vicinity because he knew it was only a matter of time before Sulla caught up with him. Now, while he was away from Rome, Julius Caesar didn't just wait around waiting for what happens next, if he would be pardoned or he would not be. He went to enroll in the military in one of the Roman regions called Asia. Asia is actually modern-day Turkey. Now, while fighting in Asia, in the siege of Mytilene, Caesar was awarded the civic crown for saving a citizen's life in battle. This happened in the year 79 BC. The civic crown is almost like modern-day Medal of Honor. It's symbolized by a wreath of oak leaves being placed on the head of the awardee, which is Julius Caesar at this time. I remember even the picture on my cover art of Julius Caesar. It's a man with a wreath on his head, a wreath of flowers. It looks like flowers are interwoven together. So it's not just a wreath of flowers on his head. It's actually called the civic crown for an award. Now back to Rome. Julius Caesar's mother, Aurelia, remember she came from a powerful family. She used her influence and along with the help of Julius Caesar's high-placed friends and relatives. They all appealed to Sulla that he should pardon Julius Caesar and let him come back to Rome. After a while, Sulla agreed and pardoned him, but he gave them a warning. In his word, quote, "This young man you have been so desperate to save, we one day destroy the optimates you have worked with me to preserve. For in this Caesar, I see many Emerius." I think Sulla was a very far-sighted person. He must have seen this guy as, this is not the normal kid on the street. I mean, Julius Caesar was only 19. And he stood up to him, a dictator, and said, "No, I'm not divorcing my wife." And he escaped. Now he was coming back to Rome. So Sulla must have seen something different about this guy. Probably that was why he let him come back to Rome, or he just wanted to appease the upper class. I don't know. But one thing I do know, even though he let Caesar come back to Rome, he confiscated Cornelia's dowry that was paid to Caesar when he married Cornelia. He took it and it became state property. Now, Caesar didn't return to Rome until after Sulla's death in 78 BC. And when he returned, he moved back to the neighborhood where he grew up in, that is Sebura, and started a career as an orator and a lawyer. The training that being in this office gave him was that he learned how to make logical arguments and persuasive speeches. Julius Caesar, throughout his life, was known to be an eloquent and persuasive orator. This attribute comes to play when he convinces Crassus and Pompey, two mortal enemies, two men that hated each other, but he convinced them to ally with him in order for him to form an alliance with them. This was where the first triumvirate came to be. We're going to talk about this in the next episode. Now, in 75 BC, while Julius Caesar was going to Greece in a ship, he wanted to further his studies. He believed that it was time for him to learn even more than he already knew. He was kidnapped by pirates. Yeah. And these pirates held him for a ransom and asked for his family to pay 20 talents. 20 talents was quite a lot of money then. Like, a talent is a lot of money. Talk more of 20 talents. However, something funny happened. When Julius Caesar heard that the ransom that was going to be requested on his head was 20 talents, Julius Caesar was angry. Yes, the young man was angry. He told him, 20 talents is too small. I am worth more than 20 talents. And he insisted that at least 50 talents would do the job. The pirates were confused. The pirates were like, okay. But they went ahead and requested for 50 talents. Julius Caesar was held in captivity for 38 days. And in that time, that's a little over a month, he actually formed, a little good relationship with the pirates. Plutarch describes it like he wrote poems for them, he sang and danced, joined them in their sporting activities. But all the while, he warned them that he would track them down and crucify them for what they had done to him. He said he was going to do that after he was released. And I'm very sure at that time, nobody took him seriously. I mean, this is a man that stayed with you for a while. Even if they were his captors, he was more like the boss of the ship. Like, it was described that Julius Caesar would order them around and tell them to stop singing and dancing when he wanted to sleep. Makes me imagine who was the captor and who was the captive. Well, something about Julius Caesar, he's a man that says a word and makes sure he carries out that word. After he was released, that is, after the ransom of 50 talents was paid, Julius Caesar gathered volunteers, tracked the pirates down, and captured them. He didn't just capture them, he actually had them crucified, as in he had them killed. This was done by Julius Caesar as a warning to other pirates who might entertain the same thoughts to kidnap noblemen, because one of the reasons why the pirates kidnapped Julius Caesar was that he was a nobleman. He did it to pass across a message to any other person who had a plan or had entertaining any ideas of kidnapping noblemen. He was going to come for them. The only thing he did for them, which is actually kind of, I don't know, it's kind of funny, because according to him, they treated him well. Instead of killing them, just straight up killing them, crucifying them until they die, Julius Caesar had their throats slit, like he cut their throats open so they would die before they were crucified. But either ways, he had them killed. He was more like a ruthless yet merciful executioner. Julius Caesar was a combination of opposites, really. That man was something else. In 69 BC, once again, death plagued Julius Caesar's life. He lost two people, actually. His aunt, the wife of Marius Gaius, and his wife, Cornelia. She died at the age of 28. That's his wife now died at the age of 28, while his aunt died at a good old age. They both died in the same year. Julius Caesar was off fighting when he was told of news of his wife's death, and he came back to conduct a funeral for her. As at that time, lavish burials for young women was not common at all. They just buried them quietly, but Julius Caesar threw an outstanding burial for his wife, and he gave speeches for both his wife and his aunt's burial, and that showed that at heart, Julius Caesar was actually a man who valued family. In spite of everything he was doing, he was a man who valued family above anything. In 67 BC, Julius Caesar got married for a second time, this time to Pompeia. Pompeia was the granddaughter of Sulla. The same Sulla we're talking about then. Yes, the same dictator that banished Julius Caesar. The tide turned and he got married to his granddaughter. Of course, by this time, Sulla was already dead. He got married to her in 67 BC, and in 68 BC, he got elected as quaestor. Thereby, he got a seat in the Senate. Now, a quaestor is a public official in ancient Rome. His job was to be in charge of public revenue and expenditure. It seemed like a low-level job for Caesar at the time, but it was kind of a springboard to gradually get towards the top and achieving his dream of becoming the most powerful figure in Rome. And this is where we draw the curtain on Julius Caesar saga for today. This was supposed to be a two-part series, but it just keeps spilling over, keeps getting longer. So forgive me, but we're going to have, hopefully, the final episode by next week, Throwback Thursday. In the third and final episode of the Julius Caesar saga, we are going to look at the first triumvirate, the conspirators, the assassination of Julius Caesar, and the impact of the death of Julius Caesar on the Roman Republic, or what was left of it after Julius Caesar's death. Okay, people, until next Throwback Thursday, keep making history. Bye.